everyone. My name's Nicholas Bentley. Today I wanted to talk about my own private investigations into copyrights, and especially copyright in the digital world. And I asked the question, is copyright on the right track? I want to start with a brief introduction to copyright and how it has been in the analog world. I then want to introduce what I call an intellectual contributions model as a way of looking at copyright and how society can deal with copyrighted material. Moving on from that, I want to present what I call the rights office system, which is a distributed system on the internet for managing rights to intellectual works, a system which would not require DRM or other technological protection measures, not even systems like levies or flat taxes. At the end, I would like to summarize the rights office system and invite any questions or responses you had. Copyright is part of our intellectual property regime, obviously, which includes patents, trade names, industrial secrets. I'm concentrating on copyright, but it could have an impact on patents, especially when we start talking about software patents, which might be interest to some of you. A short history of copyright, which I hope you will find interesting.
Nature has made any one thing less susceptible than all others of exclusive property. It is the action of the thinking power called an idea, which an individual may exclusively possess as long as he keeps it to himself. But the moment it is divulged, it enforces itself into the possession of every one, and the receiver cannot dispose himself of it. Thomas Jefferson, August 13, 1813. Despite the Constitution's guarantee of limited copyrights, a group of media conglomerates in the 20th century had a wonderful idea. They showed their disdain for the Constitution's ideals and descended upon Congress like a plague. Through power, money, and lobbying, they got the Congress to rewrite the laws circumventing these constitutional guarantees. Finally, the entertainment cartel convinced the media, which they owned, and Congress that the real crooks were their customers, and they went after them.
Blasphemers, idolaters, for this you shall drink bitter waters. Those who will not live by the law shall die by the law.
If today's copyright laws were written into the Constitution, here are a few classics we might not see today. If the entertainment cartel succeeds in passing the laws they want, here are some of the great public domain works and new technologies we can expect to see in the future. By the 21st century, a small group of mega media giants will control virtually everything the public sees and hears, and the people will never realize it.
So this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause.
Good. It ain't wrong, never do no harm.
Well, thanks to Rick Fulkerson for that. He gave me permission to use it, but of course it raises a number of questions and many issues. He had rather an American perspective to this and rather dire predictions for the future under the DRM, which may come to pass, and it could well affect us all. But it sort of highlights two ends of the scale. One group demanding DRM and control of all copies. At the other end of the scale, you have people would like to see everything for free. Another issue brought up by the film is the complicated rules in copyright. Were those clips copyrighted? Was I allowed to claim fair use by showing them all to demonstrate a principle? All these questions arise. I would like to claim that we shouldn't abandon copyright, but we need to carefully analyze where we're going to go in the future. To quote Lawrence Lessig, he said, "The balance of intellectual property regimes is a function of the technology of the time. As the technology of copyright has changed, so has the laws." And he went on to say, "The problem here is not the technology, not something called copyright. The problem here is a law, a regime not fit to the technology." And I would like to echo his comments here to say, as the technology changes to a digital world, we need to review the copyright regime and how it works. One other point I'd like to make here as well is, in the past, with analog copies, books for instance, we tend to think of property. The phrase intellectual property reinforces this view. And I like to ask the question, what would it be like if we thought not of property, but something else? What about if we thought of all the contributions which went in to the books which came before us? What about if for the time being we, for a few minutes, think of intellectual contributions rather than property? As I said, with a book, it didn't come out of thin air. There were probably many works which came before it, and many works which came before them, all leading up to one new contribution. I like to argue that these contributions aren't just a one-way stream. There are reverse contributions, if you like to put it that way, which refer to works which came before. Citations is one instance of this. If you have a book, usually at the end of it, there's many references to the works which came before. And I see this as a contribution to the works which came before. It highlights the important works, it highlights the authors who created these works, and this is an important part of a dynamic system of intellectual contributions. We can even extend this thinking. Recommendations. If I recommend a book to somebody and you go out and buy it, that's a contribution back to the original author. Reviews cover the same principle. A good review of a book will promote more sales, more reading of that book, and help distribute the information and contributions. Citations I've already mentioned. Quotations are even more dynamic. I'm allowed to quote a work or a piece of a work, from an original work, and at the same time refer back to the original work. Part of this dynamic contribution chain, as I like to see it. And finally, I add payments to this chain. Buying a book can lead to funds going back to the author, which can help him recoup the costs of writing the book, and most probably help him finance the creation of a new work. And so I see the remuneration chain payments as part of this contribution chain, and it is an important part. Just a point here, I'm taking books as an example. Obviously, any medium works under the same principles. To try and express this more formally, I've divided the screen, top and bottom, into tangible and intangible at the top and tangible at the bottom. When an author first creates a work in their head, it is intangible. No one else can get hold of it. Expressing this work, like I am to you, is still pretty intangible, but it can quickly become tangible if it becomes a hard copy. Again, looking at the analog world, this would be in books or records. So I've distinguished between the intangible and the tangible, and to demonstrate the legend of this drawing a bit more, I also make a distinction between private goods and public goods. And this is in the economic sense, where a private good is excludable from anyone else getting hold of it. A public good is less so. It is freely available to anyone who can get hold of it. To highlight this in the case, the square boxes I call a private good. The work in the author's head is definitely private. No one else can get hold of it at that stage. A manifestation in a book or a copy in a book is more or less a private good. You can lock the book away. No one else can get at the content. When I'm speaking to you, as I said, it is very much a public good. The door's locked. That's true. But by example, I can't say this half listen to the work and that half don't listen to the work. It doesn't work that way. Maybe I've already put the back half to sleep, but that's a different argument. Moving on from this diagram, using the same notation, I'd like to look at the works in the analog world. And this copyright regime worked well in the analog world because the intangible expression was most often tied up with a physical, tangible book. And there you can see this linkage throughout the analog world. And this had one important effect, that it was pretty much self-regulating. Not many people had a printing press, and so for the average consumer, it was easier just to go and buy a book rather than try and reproduce a copy. And this was an important aspect of the operation of the copyright regime in the analog world. And I'll be coming back to this, and I'd like you to bear that in mind. Moving on again, you probably all understand this. immediately we go to a digital world with digital copies flying all over the place in computer systems, over the internet. This tangible aspect of the copyrighted works tends to disappear, and we're left with a whole mass of intangible works freely copied, very much a public good. Thinking of DRM, for an instant, this is usually applied to digital works, and the aim of DRM and technological protection measures is usually to try and lock up these intangible copies again with control, central control, and various other hardware, software protection measures to restrict access, trying to force the digital copies back into a tangible private good status. You probably think like me that this won't be possible, but they're still trying, and I argue that even if we could devise the perfect DRM system which could protect every copy and avoid this public good free-for-all, it would still have a serious consequences on what I call the intellectual contributions model. It would impact privacy and the freedom to use the work in a fair use fashion. It could limit quoting and the first sale, and I believe all these would have a serious impact on what I call the two-way interaction in the intellectual contributions model. I see levy systems as having equally an impact on the contributions model. Okay, you can say, never mind where the content's going, let it flow freely throughout the world, but we'll charge a flat tax to refund the authors. I'd like to argue from the intellectual contributions point of view, this still would not work satisfactorily, because can you be sure that the author who is creating the truly useful, valuable work is the one receiving the correct compensation? And can you be sure of even identifying the authors and the works if they're freely moving around the system? At this stage, I ask the question, is there another way we could regulate the intellectual works? And the conclusion I came to was we should go back to the fundamental and look where the private goods are in this system at the moment. And you still have the author's work, when it's in its head, is still very much a private good. And when the consumer consumes the work, it's very much a private activity. And so I ask the question, is it possible to regulate the remaining private goods in the system? And, the solution I propose is what would happen if you actually allocated rights to these private goods. The author, you could argue, already has some rights under is granted rights under copyright, but if we had a system where these rights were formally registered, and of course, what would happen if when the consumer purchases a copy, they had formal rights giving them access to the work. So that is the question I asked from this thinking of intellectual contributions. To recap so far, I believe copyright has worked well in the past. Don't give it up too easily. All contributions to the work are important. Property can tend to distort our thinking. Is DRM the right way to go? And finally, I propose the possibility of a new regime where we consider purely rights rather than property or copies. I now want to introduce what I call the rights office system, which might be a means of regulating these rights. I will first try and explain the operation of the system, and then its sort of operating principles, and then move on to the results of using a system like this. I propose that there should be databases, which I call rights offices, set up on the internet, many of them. Some would act for the primary rights holder, the author in this case, some for the secondary right holder, the consumer right in this case. I'd like to emphasize that I'm not limiting this to just authors and consumers. I'm trying to keep the explanation as simple as possible and obvious as possible. Between these two rights offices, you could have publishers, distributors, and many other middlemen. How would this work? I propose that these rights offices would be secure databases. They would have secure protocols for passing information between each of them, and also to the authors and other users of the system. If a consumer was purchasing a work from an author, the author's rights office would generate an identification. This would be a unique identification, and at the same time, the consumer's office would produce a unique identification. And the two offices would exchange these identifications and thus register a transfer of rights from the author to the consumer. At the same time, these two unique identifications would be added to any copy of the content as it transfers to the consumer and would remain with the content from then on. Pardon?
How do we ensure that the identifiers remain with the content?
I'll come to that. Okay. To emphasize the fact that it's not as simple as my original diagram demonstrated, there would be hundreds, thousands, millions of these rights offices, all acting independently. Does not rely on central control in any form, and consumers could choose which office they wanted to represent them, and authors the same thing. Obviously a big publishing company or something might set up its own rights office, they'd be free to do so. The next thing I'd like to look at is, in slightly more detail, is the identifiers and the content itself. Both the identifiers would be persistent URLs, I propose. One identifying the author's rights office, the other the consumer's rights office. I'd like to point out at this stage, these identifiers would be opaque, I like to call them. They identify the office which has issued the identifier, they identify the content, but they do not necessarily identify the user. The consumer, for instance, registering with a consumer's rights office would have to divulge some identity to the office, but it need not go any further. And these two identifiers introduce a private good in the economic sense into the system, and I call it a product rights descriptor. The name is not important. The content, as I said before, can be any type of content, music, film, etc. To give a practical example, you may have seen at the bottom of my presentation here the little logo. That is the rights descriptor for this presentation. If I look at that in more detail, it has a URL pointing to the author's rights office, which happens to be me, and it's just looking at a local copy, not to bother to go onto the internet. It describes the work, it can contain other metadata, it tells you where to contact the author or how to get more copies. It can contain any of this information. For the other identifier, the second one, which would be the consumer's identification, the only record for that would show that it's a valid identification for the product. It would not tell you who the consumer was. In this case, I've allocated the rights descriptor to the Chaos Computer Congress. And having allocated that, they're free to film it, record it, and reproduce it. And so that's just by way of example of how it might work. It could have a link here back to the author's rights office for somebody who wanted to obtain their own copy, but other than that, it need contain no more information. Okay, a little overview of the rights office system so far. It would have numerous independent secure rights offices, databases on the internet, exchanging secure information. It would have numerous persistent pairs of IDs attached to all content. And as I said, these IDs are opaque, only identifying offices, not necessarily individual users. Like all systems, it has to have a few rules, but the rules in this case are very simple and straightforward. The one primary rule is removing an identification from the content or corrupting the identifiers would be illegal. And there was a question just a little bit earlier, what's stopping somebody removing these identifiers? Nothing at all, except the fact, why remove them and make the work legal when you can leave them in place and anyone can use the content. It makes no sense to do so. Another rule, second rule, is anyone who owns one of the identifiers can make unlimited copies, make unlimited use of the work. If they want to transfer it to a CD to play on their car stereo or whatever, they are free to do so. That is, the person who owns one of the two identifications attached to the content. Obviously, the author has these rights, and the consumer who purchases a copy or whatever, they would have these rights to make unlimited copies. Only
when it's illegal to remove the identification and it's legal to make copies on any medium, what if the medium doesn't support the identification? For example, an analog cassette or something?
This is obviously mainly focused on the digital world in the future. If you were to transfer it to an analog cassette, I would, or whatever, yeah, some other medium which didn't directly support the identification, you could physically transcribe the URL to the object, or somewhere have some link to the object from a file. Yes, if you printed the cassette sleeve with an ID on it, that would be good enough as far as the system's concerned. And the third rule is that to issue new content with a new identification is you have to have the identification rights to do this. And the author obviously has all rights to the product. They would have these identification rights. If they sold on the work or transferred the work to a distributor or publisher, they might also transfer identification rights so a publisher or distributor could then start issuing works or selling works and issuing new IDs. And the rights office system could track all of these rights. I was trying to keep the explanation fairly simple at the moment and only dealing with consumer rights, but nothing would eliminate middlemen from the system. Those were the rules. Now to discuss a few of the rights. I propose a common right of access, that if you have a copy of this content with valid IDs on it, anyone is allowed to consume the product, read it, listen to the music. Doesn't matter where the copy came from, if you have a validly identified copy, anyone can use it. And I think this satisfies a very important social principle that, for instance, in the analog world, if you find a book sitting on the chair, there's nothing to say you can't read the content. Moving on as quickly as possible. Author's rights. As I said, they would initially have all rights, but they could transfer some of these rights to others. From the consumer's point of view, the average consumer, they would typically, purchasing a piece of content, they'd have what I call private rights. They could make unlimited number of copies to satisfy their need to access the work. They could even give it away to friends and acquaintances. There would be a slightly different set of rights if you were talking about public sharing, like putting it on a website or somewhere where it is available totally to the public. but I will show a couple of business models later on where it might be quite feasible and even advantageous to do this. So it doesn't limit copying. And finally, there would be a whole gamut of commercial rights. Too difficult to go into at the moment, but it does not preclude these. The rights office system, as I've described it, is the two offices exchanging a piece of content or effectively making a contract. And any users, after this contract has been made, can confirm their rights by contacting the rights office. And the important point here is that the Consumer's Rights Office will be acting in the interests of the consumer exclusively. The Author's Rights Office will be acting in the interests of the author. And as they transfer the content and transfer the identification, they are duplicating each other's registration, and which avoids any possibility of cheating at that stage. And this dual monitoring of the identifiers is self-regulating. Good faith. The question was if you can assume that the Consumer's Rights Office is acting independently, or
we're going to need to have, assuming that the right to have his records transferred to another Consumer Rights Office.
You could. This is getting a bit technical. Yes, that you could introduce a system where you could transfer rights from one consumer office to another. The main principal point is that the consumer can choose which office he wants to represent them, and obviously the reputation of that office for acting fairly and efficiently is important. And as I've already discussed, every copy is identified, and there's no reason to remove the identification. In fact, there's a positive disadvantage to removing it, that you'll be holding an illegal copy. By keeping the identifications, no matter where you got the content from, you're holding an illegal copy, so why remove them? Assuming all those principles and the operation can be met, just listing a few of the potential advantages. You'd have clearly identified rules, registered consumers' rights, personal information is protected as you act anonymously with the offices. The common right of access is protected. You would tend to have automatic and permanent archives. The Author's Rights Office would probably record an archive with the issuing of the ID. No central control, totally distributed. And an interesting feature is once we don't care where the copies are or how many copies there are, the potential to use the digital technology to full advantage, P2P networks, reducing bandwidth, any other of the techniques. Also, the establishment of these offices provides a framework for any other rights management or metadata databases connected with the content. An important aspect, of course, or important question, is how could you use this in a business environment? And what are the sort of incentives for people to buy copies if there's going to be identified copies freely available and floating around on the internet and in P2P network. And again, here you, I believe you have to go back to the contributions model, which is dynamic, and identify where the real value in the system is. The value of in the system is the author who creates something really important and which people want. The musician who creates the best music, the popular music, and the way the business models should be structured is identifying this and the rights office system with the link between the two offices provides a dynamic system for monitoring or for promoting these links. Some examples of business models might be if you sell a product and it's recorded in the rights system, you might offer future products to as a discount. Therefore, it's a positive benefit for somebody to actually buy the rights of access to that content. Upgrades. This is obviously something which would affect software if it was issued in this system. The people who have purchased rights to the system could get automatic upgrades. People relying on a second-hand free copy somewhere would not necessarily have this facility available to them. I have even more adventurous business models where you'd be encouraged to freely distribute the identified content, but if someone further down the chain decided they would like to become a rights holder and bought the content, this could trigger off a refund of a small percentage or something like this back to the original purchaser of the content and thus encourage the support and the purchase of the identified works. Another example might be bands have sometimes relied on their fan base to pre-buy a product, and the rights system could record this, and immediately the product was available. It would be instantly available to them because of their rights access to it. Again, this is reflected in the use of the potential use of P2P networks. Another interesting point is if a system like this was established, you have a system of rights offices that are secure, transferring secure protocols and information between each of them. There's no reason why they couldn't transfer funds at the same time. And it might open up the possibility for a true micropayment type of system where you could just pay small sums of money, which would be an electronic transfer from your consumer's rights office to the author's rights office or the distributor's rights office. I have to keep moving on here. Why will it work is the question I always get asked. And I can't give a categorical answer that it will work, but only point to tendencies which suggest that it could work. You may have heard of Magnatunes. It's a software, a music distributor, publisher, which works on a shareware model. They have very lax control of their copies, where it goes, but even still, they manage to sell a good proportion of their works, and they offer a range of prices, and they even earn more than the minimum asking price for the copies of the work. Marillion offers a fan base model where they get support directly from their fans. A recent EU consumer survey has found that 63% of the people said they would pay more to have content always available and available wherever and whenever they want to use it. And the rights system would obviously support this. And an important point here is, even if you lost all your content, your house was burned down, you could still go back to your rights office and say, I still own this valid identification, just give me another piece of content which matches this identification. A brief mention of the Creative Commons here. The moment to institute the rights office system, it would require a license system, basically, like the Creative Commons. The big difference is the Creative Commons licenses a work, a piece of content, and anyone who gets hold of that obtains that global license. The big difference in the rights office system is licenses are issued to individuals, not globally on a piece of content. And this is what could allow a true business framework, which I think is lacking from the Creative Commons model. But as I say, the rights office system would still support the social common access to the work, which is what the Creative Commons are trying to achieve. As I said before, the system is, I propose, self-regulating. I mentioned some of these before. Again, more incentives for people to actually buy the content. There are direct benefits and permanent rights of access, no limit on copies, rapid access if you could use P2P networks, freedom to create derivative works even. There would be perhaps more rules here, but we have not time to go into them. The moral advantage. A lot of people would find it important to be able to say they own this content and have a right to use it, and this would be well established. Also, many people like to think they are supporting their artist or author and would willingly do this. And I've also briefly touched on dynamic benefits of this setting up a distribution chain where there's a link between the consumer and the producer, and which can, this link can be promoted by providing follow-up works and feedback. And effectively, you could even say the consumer is buying a share in the work and a share in the success of the author. Would it be possible to implement such a system? I don't have all the answers, but I don't see a legal or technical problem why not. It would be technically complicated to set up, but no more than any other distributed system on the internet using protocols and secure services. I would like to argue far more less complicated than setting up DRM, where you're trying to control every device, every piece of hardware on the network. Legal problems, at the moment I would, as far as I can see, you could implement it using licenses under the copyright system. I don't propose abandoning copyright. It's still valuable for analog works. It's just an extension to the copyright system, bringing it into the digital world where you actually are allocating rights to consumers and other users. Of course, it would need a lot of development, a system for producing millions of persistent identifiers. The costs of this are somewhat unknown to me. If the costs were horrendous, it would not be feasible. But as I see it, though, with the progress of technology, it is not insurmountable or overly complicated. Licenses would have to be written. You'd need legal expertise to do this. Finally, if I would say, I need help. If you think it's a really bad idea or you see something wrong, please tell me about it. If you have other ideas, please tell me about it. I would love to talk to anyone about it. I propose if afterwards you make yourself known to me or we could get together. Just to finish off, my question was, are we on the right track? I've tried to propose another system, an alternative, to put us on the right track. And that's it. As I say, if you want more information, please go to the Common Rights website and or just click on one of the identifiers for this speech, which will give you a link to more material. Thank you. So, any questions or too complicated?
what is the budget enforcement? No, did you repeat
the question? Oh, there's a microphone.
How do you see doing enforcement of this? Is this the same way that it's done today, that the rights holders would try to find illegal copies and then try to sue the people involved? Or do you see any other way of doing enforcement, such as trusted computing or all the other proposals today that it's done on DRM?
Well, as I said, I see no need for DRM, and as I also said, enforcement would be partially self-regulating because an illegal content under this system would be one which has had its identifications removed. And I keep coming back to this question, why remove the identification and make it illegal when you could just leave the identifications in place and have a perfectly legal copy? Obviously, you would need protection for the rights offices and their security. Somebody trying to hack into a rights office is doing wrong. You would have to rely on the normal law enforcement procedures to try and tackle that. The rights offices themselves would tend to be self-regulating, as I said. The author's rights office is acting for the author. They have a vested interest in maintaining security, issuing valid IDs, and exchanging them reliably with other offices. And it's the same with the consumer's office. It has a vested interest in protecting its consumer. And these two offices are checking each other. And so, for the most part, they'll want to act sensibly. The other point is, it's a distributed system. Millions of these offices, if there's an office issuing false IDs, messing up the system, like any other node on the network, it can be bypassed. You just stop, other nodes on the network would just stop dealing with that rights office.
Do you see any kind of system that stops me from consuming content with some other person's ID on it, that I'm not telling the rights office that I'm consuming this? Because, yes, it would be an illegal copy, but that would pretty much be the same way as it's done today, without the ID.
Exactly. there would be nothing stopping you consuming somebody else's copy with their ID on it. Providing you keep the ID on it, it is legal. Nothing wrong with it. If you started posting that on the internet saying, here, I'll give you this copy, that would be illegal because you don't own the rights to it and you can't start giving it to other people. But this would be pretty obvious. Oh, another question there. Behind you.
Oh. Hi. We already have a system for registering creative works in the existing collective management system.
Yes.
How do you see the relationship between the system you're proposing? Is that already one half of the system you're proposing? If you add sort of machine-readable tags that the collecting societies would be issuing for a registered work? Or is that a completely incompatible system? Thanks.
Technologically, it might be slightly incompatible that they're not registering things in the same way and they're certainly not producing these unique identifiers. But I would see no problem for them joining the system. And as they issued content to other people, they would just issue these rights office identifiers at the same time. And yes, the rights offices could form an important part of the system and probably effectively operate their own rights office on the system. And that could be the same for libraries even. They could operate a rights office system for works which are in the public domain and or for people who want to register works completely for free. There might be a new role for libraries in the future where they could operate a rights office system free of charge. I hope that answers some of your questions. Anything else? Is that it? I guess it's time. Yes. Thank you all for coming.